Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Rings of Power, Wads of Cash edition. It's Wednesday, September 7th, 2022. On today's show, Rings of Power is the Tolkien prequel. It's on Amazon Prime. It is a lavish spectacle, but does it honor the master's vision? We will discuss. And then the feature film Breaking recounts the true story of Brian Brown Easley, an ex-Marine who took a Wells Fargo branch hostage in search of some tiny, tiny measure of justice. The film stars John Boyega as Easley and the late, great Michael K. Williams as the hostage negotiator trying to save his life. And finally, we discuss the ethics of child actors. Dana's the parent of a child performer, so she will bring much to the table there. It's a subject also made topical, I think, as people know, by the Jeanette McCurdy memoir and Nathan Fielder's controversial use of very young performers. We will discuss. Joining me is Julia Turner, the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens is the film critic for Slate. Hey, Dana.
Hey, hey.
Very psyched to discuss all of the above with both of you. It's nice to have the three of us together again. Shall we dig in? Shall we make a show?
Let's do it. Let's,
yeah.
All right. Well, as I think most people consuming media these days know, world building has become the key to blockbuster making. Lord of the Rings is kind of the original built out world in some sense. I think it's still maybe its most intricately, sweepingly, fully conceived, built out, imaginative world, complete with genealogies and legends within legends, even its own famously made up language. So it makes some sense to milk it for all it's worth. Enter Amazon Prime with Lord of the Ring, Rings of Power, a sort of mammoth prequel spun out from a material that's taken from Tolkien's appendices to Lord of the Rings. So it originally comes from Tolkien's imagination. How much they've spun it away from that is a subject of some controversy among Tolkien heads. I'm not even going to try to recap the plot, but why don't we listen to a clip? In the clip, we're about to hear Nori, who's a Hobbit child, is being lectured about a hobbit's place in the world by Marigold, her protective mother.
Wait, except Steve, they're Harfoots, because it's like 1,000 years before the thingamajig, and so they're Harfoots and not hobbits, maybe?
They're pre-hobbits? Okay.
I think they're like proto-hobbits.
No, that's fine. They're pre-hobbits. Shows you what I'm bringing to the table here today. Let's listen to the clip.
I can't help but feel there's wonders in this world, beyond our wandering.
I've told you countless times. Elves have forests to protect, dwarfs their mines, men their fields of grain. Even trees have to worry about the soil beneath their roots. But we Harfoots are free from the worries of the wide world.
This is a huge splash. It's highly budgeted. It's, I think, by any standard, it's beautifully produced, beautiful looking. Julia, let me start with you. Did you find yourself taken in by this material?
Well, so they are releasing the show week by week, which I think is smart. Like, I think as we're learning about the streaming strategy, is when you have something that is incredibly highly anticipated and has a built-in fan base, releasing week by week allows the conversation and the tension to build, but it also means that we're talking about two episodes that we've seen. And I'm curious to see how the show evolves, because I do think that in the second episode, you kind of get through the like thicket of highfalutin, breathy. I mean, that clip we just heard is dreadful. Who would want to listen to that for hours? Like, I have a feeling there's a world out there. It's like, oh my God, you're not, that's like not a person. Like, it's just
like, I have to jump in and say I'd listen to hours of you doing that accent though.
Well, we can arrange that if you'd like, but I was struck watching this by the comparison to Game of Thrones. And, you know, I don't think it's unfair to compare it to Game of Thrones because quite publicly, Amazon Prime, the streaming service that has not had that level of mega hit, has set out to create another Game of Thrones and spent hundreds of millions of dollars to do this. It's famously the most expensive television show ever made. And you can see it. It looks good. But Game of Thrones went at the kind of pomp and circumstance of a medieval fantasy with character and realism, right? Like the way that it was sort of shot and the way that the characters were introduced to us and the way that they spoke and the way that they behaved and their uncouthness and their crassness and their cunning, you sort of felt these like recognizable sparks of real humanity set in, you know, this land of legend and White Walkers and a weird ice wall and dragons and whatever the heck. And that tension is, I think, A, part of what made that show successful, and B, part of what made it appealing to a broad group beyond the type of people who think of themselves as interested in medieval style fantasy. And this show does not do that. Like, everybody speaks in that type of like long monologue about the battle between light and dark and the place in society and the kind of cutting, arresting humanism that was present in even the earliest Games of Thrones is not here. And I found it a bit eye-glazy. On the other hand, by the end of the second episode, I was a little bit curious about where it was going, and maybe the show will be able to move past the kind of pompous world building into more interesting character development as it moves along.
Dana, I think of first, let me begin by saying many extraordinary people I respect love Lord of the Rings, but I associate it with kind of like the exalted incel identity of someone like Elon Musk. I can't think of a person more opposite to that than you. I'm curious whether you were taken in by this production at all.
Because you mentioned Elon Musk, I feel the need to mention that he has already expressed his hatred of this particular Lord of the Rings adaptation.
So maybe you like it, yeah.
Which puts me more on its side just automatically. Yeah. But yeah, I'll take your question head on from my point of view. The thing that makes this particular adaptation worth watching for me is Morfydd Clark, who plays the young Galadriel, the elf character, the elf queen in the future, who's played by Cate Blanchett in the Peter Jackson movies. And Morfydd Clark is amazing. I mean, this part is a little bit of a, you know, your standard beautiful, brilliant, fierce Joan of Arc fantasy queen. But there's something about her performance that pushes it almost to the edge of obsession that I think is really, really watchable. And I just recognize her immediately. I can't remember now on the show if we talked about St. Maud, which is one of my favorite movies to be released in 2020.
Yeah.
We did, right? We talked about it.
Yeah,
and she really played, obviously, in that this kind of, you know, this driven mystic, this girl who has religious visions, someone who is kind of a Joan of Arc-like figure. And maybe that's just Morfydd Clark's beat and she will always play that kind of role. Or maybe I'm just, my love for St. Maud is influencing my watching of this show. But whenever she is on screen, I'm excited and compelled. There are a lot of other stories that I care a lot less about. But this feels to me like it's sort of a Lord of the Rings light for people who don't want the violence of Game of Thrones, right? Maybe they want to watch it with their kids. I think it would be a pretty good family show. It is not, the material, Steve, is not particularly up my alley, but I did love The Hobbit as a kid. I loved that book, could not get through the rest of the Lord of the Rings books, thought that I cared nothing about fantasy, and then found myself completely ravished by that Peter Jackson trilogy in the early 2000s, which I think still holds up as just great adventure filmmaking, you know, just beautiful sort of Miltonic epic filmmaking that is very easy to be snarky about, but it's also very hard to resist when you're watching those movies. So it's a high bar to follow up on those movies, which, you know, everyone, even people like me who are not particularly at home in the fantasy universe, loved. So what this show is trying to do seems like it's sort of mucking about in the margins of that mythology. As you say, it's based on the appendices that Tolkien wrote for the books. So it really is just the sort of fan fiction of a bunch of authors who dove in and decided to kind of massage this material into something new. And to me, it's not particularly watchable, but it looks gorgeous. It is done tastefully, although the writing could be a little bit sharper. The director of the first few episodes is Juan Antonio Bayona, who I think is a great horror director. He made the great Spanish horror film The Orphanage, and who has an eye and a feel for this kind of material. Mm-hmm. But so far, this is not a thing that has achieved liftoff for me and would keep me watching, except for Morfydd Clark.
Mm-hmm. Whoa, yeah. I have to quickly dissent on Morfydd Clark. Someone pointed out to me before I watched it that she never opens her teeth, like all of her lines she delivers like this, and then I couldn't unnotice it, and then all of her scenes were ruined for me. So I now give that gift to all of you.
That's funny. So listen, I have a kind of pet theory of binaries, which is like the world divides up into X people or Y people, and then there are these kind of pairs, these dyads. Like, so you're either Tolstoy or Dostoevsky person, a Lennon or McCartney person, a Beethoven or a Mozart person. I think the theory is facile and almost surely wrong, which is why I'm going to apply it to there being Narnia guys or Lord of the Rings guys. You're either sort of team C.S. Lewis or team Tolkien. I was just down the line a Narnia guy. I found the mythologies and of just the general portentous tone of the Tolkien project impenetrable as a kid, never returned to it. But I'm with you, Dana, that the kind of like the Harry Potter movies, I read Harry Potter in bits and pieces to my kids, trading off with my wife. I never really read an entire one through. It was fine. It wasn't really exactly for me, but you could tell watching the movies when we did them for the show that people brought their A game to the material because they thought it was worth honoring. And that's not always true with these huge budgeted projects. To use a slightly demeaning word or reductive word, a property, an intellectual piece of intellectual property that earns its huge budgets. It is a real world, a fully realized imaginative world, and deserves all of the CGI and money thrown at it. The question I kept asking as I watched this, is it possible to find something riveting, but also totally unengrossing? Like how exactly is it possible that that's my experience of this? Like this very small target I didn't know exist is exactly what this show has hit. As everyone has said, you guys included, it's visually stunning. It's beautifully cast and acted. And it's just that portentousness about a mythology that means nothing to me going in, right? So its core audience has to be fan serviced to the max, and they want that experience of re-immersion in the world. And so and especially when you do a backstory, it's like, can you believe that the origins of the, you know, hobbits are these, whatever they're called or whatever, or oh my gosh. And it's like, if you don't have those nerves to tingle, if you don't have that background with the material, it's a little lost. And yet I just found it so visually beautiful and well performed, and I was riveted but unengrossed. Like I don't care what happens, but I can't stop watching it, if that makes some sense. But Julia, this segment's just not going to be complete unless we pick up on something, which is this, to my mind, preposterous pseudo scandal about the fact that there are performers, actors of color in this. What is it about Tolkien that inspires a certain kind of person to believe that it has to be an all-white cast, or somehow the integrity of the world has been corrupted?
Well, I mean, I don't think that it's Tolkien alone. I mean, remember the flap about they made the frickin' Ghostbusters women, and people were like, it's a desecration of the text. I mean, you know, but I do think that this particular fantasy of kind of like the feudal pastoral, you know, there's castles, there's smiths, there's farmers, there's wagon, you know, it feels like medieval Europe, like as the base template, right? And, you know, I think there's some threads of like collective Western legend or something that maybe gives people roots. But I honestly wouldn't even think about it as hard as that. It's like fanboy is going to fanboy. I mean, I will say that Lord of the Rings to me is the one book I didn't finish in my childhood. I just remember it as like 50 pages of descriptions of a woods was like the starter of the first book. And I was like, this is too much for me. Like, I can't do that. And then since then, my husband read The Hobbit to our kids. And The Hobbit is so great. And like what this show actually makes me want to read is like a biography of Tolkien and how he got from The Hobbit to The Lord of the Rings, because I think there's sort of an evolution. And it's not there in Narnia, too. Like, if you know, the first books are like, these scrappy kids and their interesting adventures. And then the final one is like, somehow Christianity is a lion. And, you know, they do spin out. But I almost don't want to give the fanboy, the racist fanboy response any oxygen. Like, of course, and it's stupid, and goodbye.
The one thing I always wonder about Tolkien in any form is just what was it about modern life that he didn't like that he would make such a thing up, right? To lose himself so deeply into the construction of this world that's an anti-world to ours. Anyway, some of our listeners are going to have loved it. Some are going to have hated it. Love to hear from you guys. So shoot us a text about Rings of Power. Let's move on. Okay, well, now is the moment in our podcast. We typically talk about our sponsor, Dana. What do we have?
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we go any further, this is typically in the show where we discuss business. No doubt we have some. Dana, what's up today?
Steve, le business aujourd'hui is just to tell you about our Slate Plus segment. This week, we have a guest for our Slate Plus segment. It's beloved friend of the program, Jody Rosen, former music critic at Slate, now a contributing writer at The Times Magazine. He recently published a 9,000-word profile in The Times Magazine of none other than Willie Nelson, the musical legend. So we're going to talk with Jody about Willie Nelson and listen to some Willie Nelson in our Slate Plus segment this week. If you're a Slate Plus member, you will hear that at the end of the show. And if you're not, of course, you can sign up at Slate.com/culture plus. When you're a member of Slate Plus, you get ad-free podcasts, you get bonus content like the segment I just described, which also appears on lots of other shows on Slate, the Slow Burn, the Political Gab Fest, many others. And of course, you will get unlimited access to all of the writing on Slate.com. Most of all, you will be supporting us, our show, our podcast, the writing and the work of our brilliant colleagues at Slate. These memberships matter a lot to us. So please sign up today at Slate.com/culture plus. Once again, that's Slate.com/culture plus.
All right. Well, Breaking is a new feature film. It stars John Boyega as Brian Brown Easley. In real life, Easley was a ex-Marine who took a bank branch hostage, claiming he had a bomb in his backpack. He'd been honorably discharged, and he was owed money by the VA, by the Veterans Administration. As depicted in the film, he's a complicated man on a complicated mission to get his measly $800 that he's owed by the VA back. But really, it's way more than that. What he wants is to be seen, right? I mean, this is a guy whose humanity, as depicted in the film, is under constant erasure. The film is superficially a thriller, but in reality, it's a wrenching social commentary on America's power to make use of, and then render totally invisible vast portions of its own citizenry. I should say it is also the last film performance of the very, very, very great Michael K. Williams, still, I think, best known as Omar from The Wire. We don't have a clip from the film, but we do have the trailer. Why don't we play it?
Is everyone all right in there?
I have a bomb, and I'm going to kill myself and everybody in here. My commands and I'm men.
I'm sorry.
The VA stole my disability check. They left me homeless. I won't be able to feed my family. I need everybody to see what's happening here.
You have my undivided attention.
Get the blinds.
Get the lights!
I don't want the bank's money. Everything you do matters.
Just make good, Brian. Make good.
Okay, Dana, I mean, I don't want to demean the film by calling it a Latter-day Dog Day Afternoon, but it has certain familiar genre elements, but combined with very different, very contemporary slant on that kind of material. This is a human being who's really, really been screwed with and is deeply suffering, and it's an extraordinary performance by Boyega, if nothing else. Do you think it coheres as a movie? What'd you make of it as a film?
Yeah, this is an odd case where there's no specific thing, well, maybe a couple that we'll get to, but there's not really anything wrong with this movie, but there's not quite enough there to bring it over the top to greatness. And as you say, John Boyega is fantastic. He's the reason to watch the movie, I think. And even if you're familiar with him from, you know, The Last Jedi, obviously the Star Wars movies he's done, but also Attack the Block, which I think was kind of his breakthrough movie, the English sci-fi thriller. He tends to play these, you know, big, dynamic, forceful characters. And here he's really playing someone extremely interior, very troubled, someone who is full of self-loathing that comes out in really difficult to watch ways. Just a very different character, somebody who's sort of trying to make himself disappear at every moment and just plays it so, so beautifully. I think that the principal problem with this movie in terms of it being, as you say, a Dog Day Afternoon style hostage crisis negotiation movie, right, that takes place all in one location, this bank, is that the negotiation doesn't start early enough. Michael K. Williams as the negotiator is great, and the dynamic between them is really good. But it is a good 40 minutes into this less than 2 hour long movie before the negotiation gets started. And that's part of the story, to be sure, that there's this frustration on the behalf of the hostages and also Boyega's character that they can't get a negotiator on the phone. But at least Michael K. Williams' character could have been introduced in the outside world as someone who was trying to talk to them. It's almost as if this movie's second main protagonist on the side of the law, and really the only good lawman in the movie, right? He represents the one figure who's actually trying to help and not just find a sniper to pick off this prospective terrorist. The relationship doesn't really cement until the movie is practically over. And that was a really strange choice on the screenwriter's part, because other than that, this movie's kind of got it all. Like the two women who are being held hostage in the bank, two bank employees played by Salinas Leiva and Nicole Beharie, are both great. They're not quite given enough backstory. I'd like to know a bit more about them, but the dynamic among those three works beautifully. I like the understated nature of this movie and the fact that it doesn't build toward a big action climax. And without spoiling anything, I can say that most of the action toward the end takes place off screen. But in a strange way, this movie was almost there, but not quite. It almost like it needed another 10 or 15 minutes. As I say, it needed that relationship with the negotiator to start earlier. When it was over, I had a little bit of is that it kind of feeling. And also just a real sadness at the tragedy of this story, which I think that in a way, the bigger reference would be Fruitvale Station, that Ryan Coogler movie, right? About the also a true story about a black man hounded unfairly by the law and by the system. It was sort of a Fruitvale Station meets Dog Day Afternoon, but not quite as good as either of those two movies, unfortunately.
Julia, what do you think?
Yeah, it's funny. The movie feels slight, even though the topic is really serious and the performances are largely really great. There's some kind of like structural tinkering required to make it land with more heft, I think. But I found myself leaving the movie less thinking like, wow, what a brutal, high impact piece of cinema I have just sat through, and more thinking like, oh, it would be really interesting to watch all the bank heist movies of the last 60 years and like write a paper about like it's, you can kind of see its intellectual ideas on its sleeve a little bit too much. But, you know, I do think the kind of dowdiness of the bank, the commonness of bank robberies these days, the paltry amount of the money that he's actually trying to get back, the feeling of being lost in an unfeeling, inhumane bureaucracy, and the fact that the Michael K. Williams character, the negotiator, is also lost in a bureaucracy, right? Like, even though typically in these films, the negotiator on the outside is commanding and has the power and is the key to defusing the situation. And maybe there's some subplot where he has a conflict with his superiors, or, you know, there's always some brute who just wants to blow it all up and the negotiator wants to get everybody out safely. But like when the plot events unfold the way that they do, you don't even quite know why. Like, you don't actually see that. It's not dramatized. Like, you don't have a sense that humans are making the decisions that cause things to go this way or that way. It just feels like there's an implacability of bureaucracy and systemic power that kind of steamrolls all the human force and will underlying the movements of the plot. And that is like a strong and interesting intellectual idea that is maybe part of what's dampening the narrative. Like, I think the point of the movie is that even Michael K. Williams and all of his charisma and all of his power, like, can't actually control the situation. And that's, again, sort of like more interesting to think about maybe than it is moving.
I mean, I'll say what really landed for me about the movie is the performances of Boyega and Williams above all. You know, I mean, it's clearly the true story on which it's based and the importance of the true story. I mean, the movie is dedicated to this hostage taker for a reason. And by the end of the movie, you feel, I think, very powerfully the reason, which is that this country used his body and used his courage and used his sense of duty and then treated him like an unperson. And I think Boyega and the script bring it home in a way. I don't think it succeeds as a hostage movie. Maybe it doesn't really want to, but it seems to want to, right? I mean, one of the points of the movie is that there's this entire pre-scripted way in which this is going to go. And Easley / Boyega says it. He says, "I'm going to be killed," right? And he says it quite explicitly, "if I were white." I mean, he hears about the one previous bank robbery from one of his hostages that happened at that particular branch. And he says, "Did the guy live?" And the bank manager says, "Yeah." And he says, "So," and Boyega says, he was white, right? Like, this is pre-scripted. He is committing suicide by committing this crime, and he knows it from the absolute beginning. And here's where the movie, I think, it becomes genuinely riveting. I agree, Dana. Williams comes in way too late. It's an odd plot quirk of the movie. You're not exploiting the most interesting thing about the movie and one of the two genuinely great actors in the movie. But the script is being rewritten because the chief hostage negotiator is also a black man fighting for his dignity in America. And the absolutely riveting tension of the movie is, in what capacity is he speaking to Boyega? Is he speaking to him as the man whose sole mission is to get the two hostages out alive? Or is he speaking to him as someone who has existed under the same erasure and exploitative abuse of a racist society and speaking to him man to man in order to get him out alive? And he is trying to make Boyega / Easley believe that it's the latter. Every single conversation between those two actors, I thought, was premium cinema. I mean, not to be trite about it, I thought it was riveting filmmaking. And I was like, that's what this movie is about, right? Is, you know, to what extent has the Williams character, the man, right? To what extent is he the very kind of huge apparatus of hostage safety, of over-militarized police, using the hostages as an excuse to have all this equipment? And that's the other point that the movie visually makes, is that the public budgets are absolutely unlimited when a situation like this arises. Like, we as a society are completely prepared to throw billions of dollars at keeping us all quote unquote safe from the other, right? And yet we can't spare $800 for this guy who risked his life for this country. And so it was the oddest thing where a lot of the first hour of the movie for me is strangely slack, you know, and one of the two hostages in particular is unfortunately given the actorly burden of keeping it tense for us. Like, she's constantly kind of whimpering and hyperventilating. And I felt sorry for her because you don't feel the tension that she's vocalizing and embodying. And so you're like, that's a ridiculous performance when it shouldn't be. It's actually quite a good actress doing quite a good job, but it's like the movie doesn't justify her panic. And in fact, she's left to compensate for what's slack about the movie. And then the instant Williams shows up on the scene, it's, I think, a terrific film. So that's where I come out, Dana, on like fence sitting with this movie. I mean, I certainly would not tell people to run to see it, but I would encourage people to see it.
Yeah, I would encourage people to see it too, if only because I think it's exciting and interesting that someone wanted to debut with a film like this. The director, Abby Damaris Corman, is a young woman making her first feature film, and to come out with something that's, you know, it's this downbeat, first of all, right, based on a very depressing true story, and that really is a tiny little ensemble piece. This won an ensemble jury award at Sundance because of the tight location and the smallness of the cast, right? It truly is an ensemble, and every cast member interacts with every other cast member, the major characters anyway. So the fact that the director, Abby Damaris Corman, chose to make this her debut is exciting in itself. I would keep an eye on what she does next. And it's also a way to say goodbye to Michael K. Williams, who died of an accidental drug overdose last year, right? Just a few months ago, it seems like. He has two more performances to come, one more movie and one in a TV show. But this is one of your last chances to get to see him on screen.
Yeah, and I would send people to this. I mean, it is interesting to think about. I actually kind of want to watch it again to look at more about the mechanics of how both of their humanity and agency, Michael K. Williams's and John Boyega's characters, is kind of crushed and lost here. And it's interesting what the film is doing with that tension and with their charisma and their power and their inability to exert those forces on the world to any particular effect. So yeah, I would send people to check it out for sure.
Me too. The movie is breaking. It's in theaters now. It's not streaming yet. Go check it out and talk to us about it online. Okay, before we go any further, now a word from our other sponsor, Dana.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son, George, on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
All right. Well, I think an age-old topic of how and whether you allow your children to appear in movies or on stage at a highly professional level when they're maybe a little young to make certain kinds of decisions for themselves has gained a new topical urgency. Thanks, I would say, to two things above all. There's the I'm Glad My Mom Died memoir by Jeanette McCurdy, the actress who appeared as a very young girl on the iCarly TV show, which my kids watched. I kind of loved that show, bonded with it and with them through it. And that there are now horror stories. McCurdy has recounted quite vividly the nightmare she went through as essentially the victim of her mother and various executives associated with the show. There's also Nathan Fielder has used kids, some exceedingly, I mean, down to infancy in unusual, unexpected ways in his very postmodern kind of quasi-real, quasi-very unreal TV show, The Rehearsal. So Dana, I mean, one of the reasons we want to do this is that you are the parent of a up-and-coming child performer. You are the person least likely to be a quote-unquote stage mom that I think I know. But I'm wondering whether or not you experience it as any kind of a dilemma to have a super talented kid who seems to be ready to make these kinds of leaps.
Can I just note the irony of kicking off a segment that's linked to my daughter's acting and my relationship to it with a memoir called I'm Glad My Mom Died?
Oh, dear.
Well, to put it this way, I hope that I'm not setting up my daughter to write such a memoir one day. It's really not that analogous in the sense that obviously my daughter is not famous and has no success on any kind of grand scale. In fact, that part that she had in Modern Love, while it was a big role in the script, she had a trailer all to herself and was third on the call sheet, was almost completely cut out. So that was, you know, one of her first experiences of the actor's life on screen, seeing yourself get completely cut out. And for the most part, what she has done is, you know, school plays and local drama camps and things like that. So she's hardly, you know, fighting off the paparazzi as she walks outside the door. But this is something that has interested me for a long time for all kinds of reasons. I mean, both because she has on her own really kicked off her acting career and gotten into performing arts high school and really started doing all of this stuff in a way that has made me think about what would happen, you know, if she were to become a performing child. And also because I just finished writing this book about Buster Keaton, who, you know, was an extremely famous performing child for the first 17 years of his life, 20 years of his life, something like that, and arguably had all kinds of emotional damage from that later in life that caused him to act out, you know, drink too much, have his life fall apart in midlife, and in many ways have a typical child actor's trajectory. So I guess maybe the question we're taking on is it okay to let your children act? And I don't know that I have a great answer to that. I mean, there are a few stories, I guess, of currently working actors who had a smooth transition from being child actors to adult actors. Like Kristen Stewart comes to mind. People don't often think of her as a child actor, but she's been acting since she was 10 or so. Christian Bale, I guess, although we could argue whether or not he turned out okay, given he's got a few meltdown stories under his belt. But most of these stories that you hear, you know, from obviously Michael Jackson, Judy Garland, you know, the sort of big stories of child actors whose lives have gotten really, really tough. It just seems like more often than not, you hear about stories where things go wrong. So it makes me sort of grateful that, you know, my daughter's part got cut and that maybe she'll get to become an actor in her own time as she becomes an adult. If it had been the case that, you know, when she was 9 years old or however old Jeanette McCurdy was when she started on TV, she had a TV show and, you know, had that kind of fame, then who knows? Would I have quit my job to become her momager? I don't know. It's all just speculative at that point.
Yeah, Julia, it just seems to me there are so many fluid, unstable variables here. It's very hard to come up with a, like, you know, hard and fast formula for whether or not one should X, Y, Z. I mean, you could be a terrific parent who withheld your kid from this. You could be a terrible parent who withheld your kid from this. It seems so case by case in some sense. And by the way, as consumers, we want to watch kids cast as kids, right? Like, we don't want, you know, we don't want 30-year-olds.
Like men like kneeling.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
With like de-aging technology. And,
exactly.
That would not be good. It's such an interesting thicket. And one other reason why I was interested to talk about it actually is this big narrative investigation that Stacey Perman, a reporter at the LA Times, did earlier this year about whatever happened to Laura Lee, about the story of Laura Lee Mickles, who was this enormous child star, you know, supposedly like the next Shirley Temple, and was the subject of a major custody dispute and then just had a life that, as Stacey's reporting showed, sort of fell to ruin and then oblivion pretty quickly. And it's just an amazingly told story and an amazing example of how it's not a new trend that Hollywood has been using and abusing children and been a tableau in which parents with their own motives can treat small humans pretty terribly. But I think there's a couple issues here. One is, there's a lot of different ways to be a terrible parent and a lot of different ways to be a good parent. And in some ways, you know, you have to assume that some set of people who've been performing since they're young, it's just in them. It's what they want to do. You can see it. And the talent is there and the hunger is there. And it's really coming from the kids. And the appropriate parental response is to like support and develop that and to help the kids develop boundaries around it. And then for some, it's like the deferred, you know, transference of a desire for fame and notoriety and a public life. And I think some parents decide like, oh, well, I didn't get there on my own, but perhaps this charming little Moppet will be my ticket in. You know, so you never know what's going on in any given marriage. You never know what's going on in any given family, or it's hard to know from the outside. Although there are many very public examples of terrible parents in Hollywood, I think it's worth noting that there are also lots of terrible parents in other dynamics and other ways as well, which is also awful. But I'm not sure that child acting is like the lone landscape upon which this kind of behavior happens. The two things that seem distinct about it, though, are the financial incentives for the parents. I mean, there's sort of the fame and glory incentives for the parents and then the financial incentives for the parents, particularly for someone who gets on a show like iCarly that's really providing a recurring income that could sustain a family, presumably. And then what it is to have a kid and let them go through adolescence when you're developing your sense of self and where kind of your sense of self and self-esteem should come from, with the additional potential factor of fame, which can just be so confounding and dangerous and confusing for grownups and for everybody. So those are the two elements that seem unique. And you know, I think there are kind of better regulations in place around the financial piece of it. But the question of fame feels thorny. On the other hand, again, any kid you're raising has to figure out, like, do they have an Instagram? What do they put on the Instagram? Like, the sense of being like spectated as a human is no longer the exclusive province of people who are in screened productions.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, I think the danger is so great in part because both sides of the equation are not liable to be necessarily acting in the child's best interests. If you have parents who are vicariously, or a parent who's vicariously living through the possible glories of their kid, that's terrible parenting to begin with. They're more likely to give the kid over to the forces of the other exploiter in the picture, you know, a Hollywood production team whose interest is in getting the shot, getting the whole thing in the can and sending it to market. And that's what's going to determine the pace. It's grueling. You know, obviously there's a long history of sexual exploitation of minors, you know, so the more vicarious the parent is, the more they're willing to look the other way. That's a uniquely terrible situation, right? It goes beyond what can be covered by, I think, the range of poor or good parenting. That said, you know, what are you going to do to police it? I mean, there are all kinds of things on the second part of the equation, on the production side, legally and regulation-wise, guild-wise, that can protect kids, and those things ought to happen. I have a daughter who was, I think, actually quite a talented actress, but really set it aside for ballet. She's very good at ballet, but to get to the point where X Factor can come into play at a highly professional level, you have to be so good technically first that there's far less mystery early on about who's going to get to that level. And my daughter herself is frank about it. She's not at that level. So there weren't these tormented dilemmas, never faced us as a family at all. But they, you know, in a smaller way, they're there. You know, like when you play Clara, even in a rinky-dink production of The Nutcracker, you know, there's a lot riding on your shoulders. So I know what it's like to navigate those things. I think to me, it was always about a continual dialogue with my daughter about what she wanted and why she wanted it. A defining experience of her life, as she herself articulates it, is seeing a physical movement that she believes is impossible for her to learn or do successfully. And over time, that first time you break through and you do it properly and land properly to the point that you can do it as if you were born being able to do it, is not only so defining of her experience as a ballerina, but as someone who now really weirdly loves physics. She says that the analogy is just perfect. It's like, I can't do that. My mind cannot comprehend that equation. It's counterintuitive. It's abstruse math. I'm not capable of that. How amazing that in a month or 6 months, it'll seem as natural to me as breathing. It was the paradigm laid down by the physical demands of ballet that allowed her to be that person. But if that had come from me, it would be sick, right? It would be, or her mother or anybody, right, in her life, that would have been kind of a horrible thing to force a kid to do, because, you know, there's a chance you don't complete the movement and you're a failure, and that becomes paradigmatic to you. So it's just a question, as you say, it's that X factor, Julia. Are you a good parent? Like, are you empathetic to the actual agency and internal existence of your own kid? And how do you codify that, right, in this set of rules? I mean, you just can't.
Yeah, and comes back around to the question that, like, I think I still wrestle with, people still wrestle with as grownups, which is like, there's work for glory, achievement, praise. There's the good and bad motives around working hard towards a goal, right? Which sometimes, you know, obviously a lot of times children have to work hard in school and to learn and within the context that is like intended for children to develop those skills. And I think child performance exposes them to the fact that those questions don't actually end, which is like, why do you work? Why do you work hard to achieve? Is it about, you know, ego and what people say and how it looks? Or is it about the satisfaction of exerting yourself in the world and that feeling and what it means to try to do that better? And those are just really big questions to put on children's shoulders. On the other hand, children are always thinking about the big shit, you know, like the notion that they aren't, can't, don't, is almost always wrong, I think. I believe they clock us and they know what's up and they know the score. And the question is sort of how to connect with them and understand what they're really thinking and worrying about and coach them through all that rather than pretend it's not happening.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I feel like I have trouble participating in this conversation without feeling like I'm bragging, but I honestly think that 100% of my daughter's impetus to perform comes from her, although I couldn't be happier than I am to have a daughter who's into performance. And as someone who spends my life watching art and thinking about art and writing about art, it's obviously great to have her emerging in an artistic genre of her own. And she has, I think, more drive to do that and to develop herself as an actor and singer and dancer and performer than I had to develop myself as anything as a kid, even though I also sort of realized a vocation early and knew that I wanted to do something with writing and language. It was much more inchoate and just sort of like, I want to daydream and read books. But it is extraordinary to witness her figuring that out for herself.
Fabulous. You did not sound braggy to my ears at all. That was great. All right. Well, say at the end of most segments, we really want to hear from our listeners, but this is a highly personal one. And I'm sure many of you had experiences of your own growing up or as parents or just people in the orbit of younger children who have been performers. Love to hear from you. So shoot us an email. All right. Well, before we continue, let's hear a word from our other sponsor, Dana Stevens. What do you got?
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep. While you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you bring us today?
Well, since for our plus segment today, we're having on friend of the program, Jody Rosen, to talk about Willie Nelson and Texas music, I thought I would recommend some Texas music. I was in San Antonio, my hometown, last week doing a book event, which was a great experience. My high school French teacher showed up and had me sign one of my books to her, which was a wonderful moment. The kind of thing that you think about, you know, before you write a book and think, well, that could never really happen.
Fun.
It was so great. And while I was there, I saw a friend who is a musician who has a band called Buttercup that's been around. They're sort of a San Antonio institution. They've been around probably 20 plus years now and have various spin-off side projects, et cetera. And as a parting gift, my friend Eric Sandin, who's the lead singer for Buttercup, gave me their most recent disc. It came out a few months ago, and it's a pandemic album. It's a 6-song, almost like an EP, a short little album that's all autobiographical songs written by various members of Buttercup, who I guess I would characterize as a kind of indie band. I don't know what their style is exactly because they change from album to album, but this is a very quiet, acoustic-y style indie album anyway, and it's called Specs, an autobiographical record by Buttercup. And if you really want to support the band, please listen to it on Bandcamp. You can hear all their music from the last few decades on Bandcamp, or you can buy a disc there as well.
That sounds amazing. Julia, what do you have?
Just going to go with a little more Strut Overflow. I've just have been spending so much time with this playlist. And this was a song that was actually, I think, on both Dana's and my shortlist. But it's by a Belgian artist who sings in French and called Angèle. And it's called Oui ou Non.
Oh, I love that song.
Dana, yes, that was on my shortlist for sure. Really, really catchy.
I always find I sort of live with these playlists, the long list, for a while after our Strut. And it's interesting which songs kind of endure and stick with you and give you that little jolt when it cycles around to them. So Oui ou Non by Angèle.
I dig that song. That's so great. I offer a very, very heartfelt endorsement this week. The great, truly great Barbara Ehrenreich has died. She is the least ninny-ish leftist, American leftist, I think, who ever lived. She was the conscience of neoliberalism during its awful unfolding. She's an extraordinary prose writer, lucid, direct, simple, and never, ever gave up the fight for economic justice, which was the centerpiece of her moral universe, I think it's fair to say, as a writer. When I was a Cub book reviewer, I got sent the book Nickel and Dimed. I knew Erin Reich and admired her already, but that was the book that really broke her, and, you know, broke her big in the sense of commercially and becoming much more commonly known. That book is about her trying to survive on the minimum wage and working minimum wage jobs and detailing what that was like. And it was just, I know that people have problems with that kind of middle class standing in, but she herself was from a working class background. She had parents and ancestors who worked that way. She understood that she was very lucky not to have to, but felt she could provide a service to the world to understand what it was like and write the book. And I think she really gave serious impetus to the living wage movement because she detailed perfectly how that is an unliving wage. And very quickly, I'll say, as someone struggling for decades now to write a book about the 1980s, you know, there aren't very many good books about that decade in my estimation. She actually wrote by far and away what I think of is the best book about the 1980s called Fear of Falling. And it's a book that sort of fell through the cracks. It's forgotten. It was written in 88, I believe, but it was sort of about the fate of the middle class under what wasn't yet really widely called neoliberalism. She doesn't use the word, but under Reaganism effectively. And it is both the perfect encapsulation of what was happening and why that change was consequential and was bound to stay that way. But also it was just prophetic for what we've all been through since. There's this radical continual undermining of everything by the forces of a globalized capitalism. And there's no other way to put it. So Barbara Ehrenreich, the great Barbara Ehrenreich, I believe at the age of 81, has passed away. Honor her by reading her work. I cannot recommend it more highly.
You know, I'm so glad you mentioned her, Steve. I just was thinking about her impact and about just how profound that book, Nickel and Dime, was, not just in the living wage movement, but I think in really putting a deeper understanding of income inequality and what the working class had evolved into and what kinds of lives those wages allowed. I don't know. I just think it's such an important and influential book in terms of paving the way or using the tools of narrative nonfiction journalism to help a broader set of people understand the stakes and the landscape. I'm intending to go back and read it again, but I just think her influence cannot be overstated.
Well, yeah, thanks for that, Julia. That's beautifully put. And thank you so much. What a really nice show.
Thank you, Steve.
A lot of great stuff today. Thanks, Dana.
Yeah, it's nice to be back all together again.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. Our introductory music is by Nicholas Bertel. Our producer is Anna Rubinova. Our production assistant is Nadira Goff. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner and Jody Rosen, supreme friend of the program, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.